In every age, God raises people up to speak the truth to the world in a way that is currently relevant. Though our opinions should not be held with the same esteem as the biblical canon, we still carry the hope of Christ to the world. Our society has forgotten what it means to follow Christ. The bright lights of truth seekers are barely visible in the dim twilight of a post-Judeo-Christian society. We all see the darkness coming. All we can hope is to share the light that He has entrusted to us. This is Modern Apocrypha. I do not know who you are, but I know that you will come. My compatriot Siva Ratting tells me that he has seen a vision of a great light, hurtling into our universe, bent upon defeating the enemies that beset us from every side. Siva may be odd, but his visions have never failed to come to pass. Thus I write to you, Bright Star, to give you whatever blessing I may, and perhaps to arm you against the evils you will face. I have all but lost hope. The Nocifer, the Ilvain, and especially the Opterans plague me. Even those who are still truly human are fractious. All the mortal powers are like flies, waiting to bite me the instant I turn my attention to something more important. It has been 1,000 years since we fled, and we brought so little with us. Our history has been lost. I have only dreams to remember, Earth, and they are nothing but terror. I thought we had left Lastus Rowland and his ilk behind when we escaped Earth that was. I was wrong. Or perhaps I misunderstood the threat from the very beginning. I fear I have failed this universe, over which the Lightmaker set me as guardian. They have won. All I can do now is delay them. But I didn't set out to complain to you of my problems. I feel the burden of the looming darkness. I had to warn you of the evils I have failed to overcome. I do not foresee this universe becoming safer when I am gone. I hope I may forestall its destruction, but I cannot imagine prevailing against that many-headed void spawn that besets us. For every head I cut off the beast, it grows 2 more. I must leave vanquishing it to you. I have entrusted this letter to Terran, my son, in all but blood. You see, they have taken even my children from me. If you are able, do me this one service. Find them. Find John and Rachel. Free them from their prison. I know they will fight at your side. Look for the mysteries. I have hidden them well, but allow hope to lead, and you will find them. They may aid you in your fight. The mysteries are far too powerful for me to allow them to fall into their hands. I thank you, Bright Star, for your part is to complete the task that I have so thanklessly begun, and at which I have so spectacularly failed. Truly yours, Polka Sizia, Guardian of the Remnant. Collected by Terran Galton, Keeper of the Mysteries, in the year 337 NST.
Oh, and
hi, I'm Jared.
And I'm Greg.
And this is Modern Apocrypha, and today we're talking about Bright Star. And the reason for that is the week of this recording, it is released on Tuesday, officially on bookstore shelves. And, you know, that kind of feels anticlimactic to me, Greg, because so much has, like, gone on since I've got my first copies, and it just... I don't know. The whole thing is kind of weird, but I guess we'll get into that.
It seems like as a producer of things, the public doesn't realize once it's brand new, the producers have had it for a year, sometimes two.
Yeah. Well, and technically, you know, I guess the timeline was I got the book finished a year ago, January. So it's a year and a half ago, almost. I was doing my final edits by the end of March. I had sent it, or I was sending it into the publisher, and I signed my agreement with them sometime May of last year.
Well, and I really wanted to take this opportunity for people that may be interested in the industry. From that step, that initial step, a lot of people have trouble getting in with whoever they're going to publish with. How did you get a publisher? I mean, what would you suggest for someone that sure. wasn't able to go about it the way that you were? Yeah, and just that first step from amateur to professional, I suppose.
Well, you know, oh gosh, there's a lot there. Finishing out the timeline real quick, though. So I signed my agreement with them in May. I got my first copies in October and the end of October, and I've been able to sell copies since November. So I'm sure some of our listeners have had a copy for a couple of months now, but technically it's hitting bookstore shelves the week of April 16th, 2024. And, you know, at this point I have the second one most of the way done. I've got just a few final edits that I'm dragging my feet on. And, yeah, then there's the other thing. And we actually need to talk about the Kickstarter too, that is actually currently still live. And, that'd be a good thing to go over, but, to answer your questions. So, you know, ever since Mary and I started praying about this situation, when I started writing the book, I started asking God for the proper place to publish it, you know, to open the right doors, close whatever doors needed to be closed. And even if that meant I didn't finish writing the book and I went and did something else, that was okay with me. I was looking for God to give me the right answers. And, I got done with the book, and you know, the way God works is kind of funny. He doesn't open doors way ahead of time. It's like when it's time, then things come together, and not until it's time. And so, I get done with the book, and there were two guys online who I asked to help me out. One I asked to be a beta reader, and he wound up sort of being the cheerleader who got me through the last little bit of editing and whatever. And then the other one, I asked him if he'd share it with his following. This is a guy named Untapped Growth on Twitter. I asked him if he'd share it with his following, and if he liked it, you know, read it, share it with his following if he liked it. And he says, oh, and the, by the way, I'm pointing to the one. The other was Hammond of Texas on Twitter. FieldNAS is at, it's at FieldNAS. And so he was my cheerleader beta reader who made this totally possible. And then the other guy was Untapped Growth. And I asked him, and he said, well, yeah, I could do that. You know, my uncle's a publisher, right? And
that is just the strangest, uncanny situation.
Well, that's how God works, though. It's actually not that strange in terms of God timing and how he handles things. It's like he brings things the way they need to be. And because it had dropped into my lap like that, I'm like, okay, well, I'm not sure about this, because for people who haven't published a book, the publishing process is just about the scangiest, scariest, stupidest thing in the whole wide world. Don't do it if you can help it. I'm serious. It's terrible. But anyway, I submitted the book to his uncle's publishing house, and they did accept it. So it was the only thing I've ever submitted anywhere for publishing, and it was accepted first try. And if that's not God working, I don't know what is, man. I have never heard of it happening before.
And this line that was coming towards you was coming towards you, even though you didn't know it was there, pretty quickly after your prayer.
Well, I'd been praying for 6 months. It was pretty quick after it was needed, but it wasn't pretty quick after the prayer. It was just God had provided for me. And that, well, and I guess that gets us to the present day, though I will talk a little more about the publishing process and what people should do and all of that. But, you know, realistically, well, okay, so backing up a tiny bit, the first thing to say is that people who love me have been incredibly supportive, and I'm humbled by it, because it's pretty amazing how many people have stepped up and been a beta reader, been, you know, whatever role they need to fulfill, they've done it. And then the ones who have bought a copy just to support me, who normally aren't even readers. I had a guy do that this week. He told me he's not a reader. And the next thing I know, he's giving me money for a copy of the book. And I'm like, dude, this, I mean, are you sure? Because this really isn't. So he gave the money to one of my kids. And
situations in such a, I always look at those situations in such a God works in mysterious ways sort of way, because that book will travel to who it needs to go to.
It will. And, you know, I'm grateful to him because he sort of, in a sneaky way, he got me money for a book. And so I'm going to need to get him a book. I haven't done it yet because it was at church this past weekend, and he gave the money to one of my kids and left. So it was like, he did it on purpose. He wants a book. I will get him a book. That's cool. Thank you, Jeff. But you know, it's people, there have been a lot of people who've done stuff like that though. They've just been incredibly supportive, and I am deeply, deeply grateful and humbled. But there's this, as a professional author, what you have to do is you have to go from friends and family and people who care about you to, I have an audience out in the world that actually wants to read my material. And I don't have a way to do that. And that's usually a very slow process. And I don't have money to sit here and support my family and write for 5 more years while that happens. I just don't have it. So bottom line, God is going to have to provide again somehow, whether that is he's going to provide money for this to go the way that it, you know, the long way, or whether he's going to provide this boost in audience where things take off, or whether I go on and get a different job, or I don't have a set agenda, but it's in God's hands, and it always has been, and there's nothing I can do to control it. And one of the things that I did to test that, just actually starting just this week, it'd be last week, because I'm releasing this the week of, we record a few days early, folks. So I'm releasing this shortly after the book launched. Shortly before the book launched, I dropped a Kickstarter. And that Kickstarter is a short anthology. It'll have at least 4 short stories in it. And for me, there are multiple reasons to do this. I'm going to publish it one way or another, but having this Kickstarter go well would be a good thing. Part of the reason I dropped the Kickstarter, there were like 5 reasons. One of them was to see how much actual audience support I have, where the rubber meets the road, they're willing to step up and buy what I put out. It's like, where is the take my money crowd? I have 1 supporter so far who has pledged to this Kickstarter after 4 or 5 days. So number one, go pledge to the Kickstarter, because it will still be open when this drops, and it's open until the end of April. But actually at this point, I've learned what I need to learn as far as that goes. I know how, because I'm trying to keep track of how much audience I have right now that is on my email list, that is on my social media, who's willing to go buy the book when it drops, the next book or whatever, so that I can know what kind of revenue I can plan on having for the next projects. So it's sort of a measuring stick. And I've made the measurements I need to measure right now. I know approximately where I'm at.
Having talked to authors in the space and whatnot, have you been able to figure out that if you do make, I don't know, $100,000 per book, that you can make 6 books a year and that's still fine? Or are you limited? Do people tend to jump into different genres to get a payday out of it? Or what are people doing?
Well, gosh, interesting question. Can I finish the other sentence though?
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing that I was just going to say is, right now, I actually need this Kickstarter to work. It's only $200. So, you know, pledging $10-$15 for the Kickstarter is actually a huge help to me. So if you're listening to this, I actually really need you to do that. Please go pledge to the Kickstarter, because...
And the Kickstarter link is in the description below.
If you go to e6universe.com, it's there. I'll put it in the show notes here as well. But the point is, one of the things that will actually help me is having successful Kickstarters behind me on my profile on the Kickstarter site.
It's kind of like your reviews.
Yeah. And so actually finishing this out is helpful, and I really need help with that. So if you're listening, please do that if you're willing. Okay, so to answer the rest of these questions, though, coming from the perspective of a professional author, let's pretend that our listener today wants to be an author. And let's paint the dismal picture that you have to contend with as a new author. One of my Twitter contacts recently said, he says, you know, people talk about starving artists with sympathy. Why not starving authors? Because authors make less than artists on average. The average indie author makes like $5 a month off his books. That's the average indie author. That's not low end. That's normal. It's pretty bloody bad. And indie means somebody who isn't traditionally published. Technically, I'm traditionally published, but traditionally published is only about 50% better by the stats than indie, because it's only the top very few percent of books that actually ever go anywhere. It's the Pareto distribution is absolutely fierce. So basically, if you want to get into writing, you better love it or be practically compelled to do it, because you're not going to make any money at it statistically. It's not going to happen. What you're going to do is you're going to publish a book that is going to be popular with your friends and family, and you're going to, they'll appreciate it, they'll enjoy it, and nothing else will ever happen. Whether you do it as an indie or as a traditional, the average number of copies sold for a traditionally published author is only a few hundred. The average number of copies sold as an indie author is only a couple of hundred. And that's pretty dismal, man. And there's no easy way to just jump out past that. You pretty much have to have a publicity company behind you to do anything better than that. And I don't mean you hire a PR firm. What I'm saying is you pretty much have to have a 24/7 public affairs group pushing you all the time. Like, you have to have a popular podcast or a popular
talk show. So what you're describing in pop words, that would be something like the attention economy favors only those who have attention, and all your work tends to be about garnering attention, or at least 95 and 5, and the 5% is the writing, and the 95 is garnering attention.
If you get to
Joe Rogan's hand, you sell more books than if you wrote a good book.
That's exactly right. And then the other part of this is that if you do, let's say you do write good books and you do have the stick to it to stay in the market, and you can put some amount of money towards your marketing, and you can figure out a way to scrape together something to actually start a snowball rolling and to start gathering some audience, you need like 5 to 10 years to actually have your network effect grow enough for it to sustain you as a living, as a way of making money. You need 5 to 10 years. And so it's rough, it's hard. And that's only a few percent of people that ever get there. Even people who keep writing for 5 or 10 years, if they don't figure out how to get the marketing right and to actually start a snowball rolling and start the network effect growing, they still don't make it. I have talked to a number of authors over the past 6 months who are in that situation where they have been out there for many years. They have many books that are published. I talked to one lady who has 70 books published, less than 70 books published. And she's still what they consider undiscoverable. She has barely a big enough audience to make enough money to make it worth her while to do it. And she loves writing. I mean, if you have 70 books published, you got to love writing. So there are critical factors that go into this. One of them would be considered luck. The other is just, do you have the attention to sell a book? You know, if you're Ben Shapiro or Michael Knowles, you can sell a book purely on name recognition. You got this great big audience, you can do that. But getting into that position is rough. It's hard. And is, you know, for them, the job is the audience. It's not the book. The book is sort of an afterthought. And if you want the book to be the primary driver, you've got to be prepared for a huge sustained campaign to get your name out. And you've got to be prepared to dump tens of thousands of dollars into the effort. And when you're done, you're still not going to have the audience you think you should. You're not going to be a bestseller statistically.
Well, and I would be cautious. I would also bring up, we've heard plenty from Daily Wire crew and whatnot, that the bestseller lists as they stand don't actually represent anything other than the current libtard's favorite book.
Well, okay, so some of that has to do with whether you're, what your personal political views are does come into it, but whether what you're publishing has an agenda or not. If it has an agenda, it can boost it to up in certain bestseller lists if you're on the left, but if you have a conservative agenda, it's going to stunt you. And that's if you, huh?
Or at least it had. I do feel like we're getting a bit of a cultural shift where the more conservative spaces will have just as exclusionary a space as the liberal areas were. It'll just be a segmentation.
Well, another great example of that is the Christian audience. That has been around for a long time, but if you try to break into those circles, that's really rough. That's something that I've sort of been poking at, because this book is technically something close to an allegory. You know, it's not quite an allegory, but it is very Christian in its themes. It is based on the monomyth, the true myth of Christ. It's based on, you know, things that should be popular in those circles, but trying to break into even that is a pretty tough sell. That's hard to do. And there, that actually has other reasons. It isn't that there are gatekeepers so much as that the network is very slow and people are very slow on the uptake there. So getting the word out there is even slower than it is in secular circles. And the people there are very conservative by temperament, which means they don't like new things.
Right. Absolutely. And they are, I would say, most often likely to sit and soak and absorb any written work until they really get a grasp on it. And so they're not going to be reading a paperback every week and really cramming through the dollars.
Right. And as a new author who's trying to actually get my name out there, you know, having an audience among Christians can help me as time goes on, but trying to get a wide enough splash to make it matter is a pretty tough thing. And I'm not complaining with any of this. I'm just trying to be realistic. If you're actually interested in publishing a book, think twice, because it's not easy. And you will not make a whole lot of money doing it unless you're willing to basically make it your life's work. And even then, you're going to spend 10, 20, 30 years floundering around before it actually takes off. It's even slower than being a conservative pundit. You know, it's like Ben Shapiro says, oh, people show up all of a sudden when really they've been working, doing the hard work for 10 years before they ever show up in the space. And it's more extreme for conservative fiction writers.
Well, and you could also take that same exact example, and who has a number one rap song has never sang a day in his life? Ben Shapiro, because name recognition, and right, you've got
that. Because he has the attention economy to do it. Yep, that's right. And again, I'm not complaining. I'm just saying this is the reality. Now, in my case, it's like I said, I have been praying since the beginning that God will help me get where I need to go, help this book get to the people it needs to get to. That doesn't mean that I get to be a famous author. That's not what I'm asking for. I'm just asking that God gets the book to the people who need to read it. And I am hoping that I get to finish writing this first series at least, because the story isn't done with Brightstar. We're only about a quarter or a fifth of the way through the first story. And even after that, there's a lot more I'd love to write because I sort of know where it's going. But I really want to get done with the first story. I really want to.
In your experience, I'm assuming you've spent a good amount of time now talking to other authors and getting their input. When you compare it to something like a Royal Road compilation, where they're selling a book where someone spent the time already, they've got, I'm more in the audible space than the written space to see it, but we'll say something like 500 pages, right? And they're putting that out every month. They're basically making a book a month on what's being put out there on a site like Royal Road. Those are getting compiled and they're outputting a book quite often to keep up with the space there. How much can you put out there, do you find, before it gets to be too much? How little is like, whoa, we need to get somewhere out there because people are clamoring that they're going to forget the last book by the time the next one comes out. We're in a strange media space where people can go to so many different ways of consuming. How do you figure out what you're going to do for these? You said the Kickstarter is 4 short stories?
At least, you know, sure. I have stretch goals in there where we may get up to 7 or 8 short stories, but at least 4.
Sure, sure. So in that space, how are you getting to the quantities that are making people notice, I suppose? Because right? You can't be so big that people go, oh, that's Kimmerian. We'll never finish that. We don't want to pick it up. But then they also don't want the little pamphlet because it's, what's the point?
Right. You know, there are different markets, right? So if you're selling to brick and mortar bookstores, which is what my publisher does, they don't want more than a book or two a year from new authors. That's anything more than that, they just won't publish it. Even 2 a year is too much for a new author in their eyes.
It seems to me that they would run up against an obvious number that they're beating their head against, that they can keep their customers at 1 or 2 a year. Beyond that, customers that buy more than that buy online and they lose the customer.
I don't know. I know that for brick and mortar bookstores, for new authors, that's what they say. They say once you have an audience, once you're selling tens of thousands of copies, then you can publish as many as you want and the brick and mortar will just keep taking you. They'll keep as many as you can put out. But up until you have a good audience, they don't want too many books. Then there's the indie author sort of audience where they actually work a lot faster. They try to put out almost a book a month. Depends on who, but you know, you get a book every month, 2 or 3, and that is enough depending on your business model. You know, if you have a small dedicated fan base, that's enough to keep you going. And that's closer to what that lady I was talking about earlier, that's closer to her business model, though she has books that are traditionally published. She puts out quite a bit of work and she has enough readers that is enough to keep her going, even though she's not widely known, because she's got so much stuff coming out, it's enough income. She's making enough content to make it work. So as an author, where do I want to be? You know, these books that I'm writing are actually hard to write because I'm trying to work on 3 or 4 different levels. It is a fun story, but it isn't just a fun story. There's more going on there. So I would love to be able to work a little slower, but you know, I haven't made enough money to even really talk about so far. So
yeah, read the book.
Right. Well, if you haven't read the book, you should. It is coming out it is out. And anyway, hey, you know, we probably ought to go to break here.
We should. Let's cut it for the timing.
We'll be back in a couple of minutes, and we actually have another story, so we'll be back.
Back in a minute.
And it's live. Bright Star is finally in bookstores, which is totally exciting and cool and pretty anticlimactic for me because I've been working on it for, what, a year and a half now. To finally have it come out is a huge relief, and I'm two steps ahead working on the next two things. So I actually need folks' help. I've got a Kickstarter up for a short anthology that's to land between Bright Star and its sequel in the series to give people a bit of a wider background on the series and origin stories on some of the characters. And I actually also need people's help to decide which character I'm going to be writing the final short story in the anthology about. So if you like a particular character in Bright Star, shoot me an email real quick, jared@e6universe.com. Let me know what character you think I ought to be writing about. And if you possibly can, please head over to e6universe.com and click through on the Kickstarter and, you know, support me if you can, because I need a successful one in the books if I can manage it. Thank you, everybody. Blessings on your day.
I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people enjoying Modern Apocrypha. As many of you have seen, I'm an avid coffee drinker, and I've been drinking North Arrow coffee for a couple of pounds now. You can find North Arrow Coffee at northarrowcoffee.co, all one word, where they list coffee of the month and how green coffee is handled. I've been enjoying some of the number 4 Honduras and some of the number 10 Peru, available at northarrow.co. If you'd like to help support us even more, you can use discount code E6 for 10% off your coffee order today. Thank you.
And we're back.
Welcome back, everyone.
So, I guess we sort of wanted to talk about the Energemetra 6 universe, what's coming up, what's next, what we're planning. Now that Bright Star is officially out and available, people will want to know what's next in the series. I have a working title for the next book in the Epimyth, that is The Veil of Mysteries. That's V-A-L-E, The Veil of Mysteries. So it's like the country of mystery. And that topic is explored in the second book. I'm currently working on writing a book with the working title Against the Odds, which is, would be book 3. So,
okay. So this is maybe a step back, but the epimyth was a word you mentioned there, and each of these titles is in the category of a quote-unquote a Bright Star book, as opposed to something in the epimyth universe that is could be set up under other characters but in the same universe.
Question in the Energemetra 6 universe, you mean?
Sure.
Okay, so The way I'm looking at it goes something like this. The Energemetra 6 universe is a pretty big umbrella. We can, and I'm hoping to publish other stories in that universe that are not about Bright Star, that have other characters that they center on, that have other focuses. They will take place in the same universe, but they're not the same characters. The Epimyth is a very specific thing. It is the series of books that is starts with Bright Star and ends with Bright Star returning home. So in the beginning of the book Bright Star, he comes into this new universe, the Energemetra 6 universe. The epimyth ends with Bright Star going home. That's my intent. And eventually I'd love to publish, because really this is a very short work by a lot of people's standards. By the time I get done with the first story, it will be a pretty good sized tome. It'll be, you know, 1,000 pages or something like that. And I'd love to publish an omnibus eventually. That's way down the road, but you know, that'd be fun. Okay. But the point is, that's sort of what's going on in that series. simultaneously, we have this anthology that I'm working on. I am going to release it one way or another. There will be people will be able to get copies of it. There's marketing reasons for that, actually. But that anthology is going to have the three short stories that are fully written that are going in the anthology are The Keeper of the Mysteries, The Boy from the Darkness, and The Boy from the Megalith. The first one is sort of written as a prologue to Bright Star, and I'm hoping to read it at the end of this segment, the whole short story on the air. We'll close with that. But the other two are talking about someone who the reader hasn't met yet in the book Bright Star, but who will later on in the series figure in very heavily. And his name is Tom Neelian. And if you're interested in getting a hold of either The Keeper of the Mysteries, the short story, or The Boy from the Darkness, you can get those right now. The Keeper of the Mysteries is available freely online at e6universe.com. The Boy from the Darkness is available to anybody who signs up to the email list. It emails it right out to you as soon as you sign up. So you can actually go get either of those right now. Those are going in a physical anthology along with The Boy from the Megalith and one more short story. And the cat's out of the bag now. I'm actually letting my readers decide who the short story is going to be about. At the time of this recording, so far people have thrown out Kevin, John and Rachel, and one person says they want to think about it. So what I'll do is I'll put out a poll. I'll have people vote on it. I'll have people decide. I'll do at least one short story that's about somebody the readers have decided that I ought to write about. And that will go in this anthology. And the reason for the anthology, and it's going to be fun, I think. It's a little more context on the universe. It's not, none of it's directly about Bright Star, but it's all about his friends. It's all about the people who will be surrounding him. They all appear in some of these stories, and it gives you more background, and it adds to the depth of lore, which is sort of useful for me as I'm writing forward in the series, because it gives me more story and history and material to look back on and sort of take into account, and it makes the world richer, which is great. Yeah. And it also, on the marketing side, gives me the ability to do things like book bundling. When I do online marketing, you can bundle the anthology with Bright Star and you can give people a deal. And people really love deals, and that's a great way to do the online marketing thing. And it also gives me two physical things to sell to people when I go to someplace like conventions. And we'll be going to GameCon later this month, I think. I've got the Wyoming Homeschool Convention. I should have a booth there, and they've asked me to do a presentation. There are a couple others that are in the works, so
we should maybe take a split second and review some of those spaces where people could come and meet and greet if they were of a mind to. Book conventions is a great place for that.
Sure. Those are the two that I'm pretty for sure on so far.
For where you've gotten scheduled events ready to go. So if someone went to your website, they'd say, oh, he's going to be here next, a la Jordan Peterson's tour kind of way.
I'll have to think on that. You know, I would love to do that. The issue is keeping it updated. I am not very good about that. And so most of what I see for authors on their websites is they put up these events, they put up the schedule, and it's still there 3 years later when all this stuff's passed, as if it were current, and they haven't updated it. And I don't want to put myself in that position. So I will pray about it. I will think about it, but I'm not, you know, I don't mind announcing on this podcast what's coming up, but
keep it live. Yeah.
Yeah, that's my tendency. We'll see. Maybe so no, there's no place X. People can go. Huh?
Maybe find you on X for announcements for where you'll be next as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Find me on X is a great place. Facebook's a great place. Both of those. Occasionally I remember to post to Instagram.
Very nice. Very nice.
So yeah, there's that. Anything else you want to talk about before I read Keeper of the Mysteries, or shall we get into that?
Let's go ahead and get into it.
All right. So folks, this story is written as a prologue to the Energemetra 6 universe. It introduces you to the characters who are present when he appears, and it's sort of an introduction to my writing style as well. And for anybody who's listening to this, who's already read it or isn't that interested, this is how we're ending the podcast. So feel free to duck out now. Thanks for being here. And for everybody else, let's read The Keeper of the Mysteries.
Enjoy.
You should not have come here. The tone of the thought was gloating and unmistakable. It grated on his mind. For what must have been the millionth time, Terran Galton gritted his teeth, wishing it was easier to tell the difference between his own thoughts and the counterfeit nastiness the Watcher slipped into his brain. If he hadn't been so familiar with that ugly feeling, he would have assumed it was his own. It certainly carried his own sentiments this time. He shouldn't have come here, but he had. On the plot stretching across the entire forward wall of the bridge, the amber star representing the Telestry's vessel winked insultingly in front of them. They had only just crossed into the Watcher's territory, which in his own mind marked the edge of the abyss. Terran double-checked their coordinates. The malevolent presence's area of influence had expanded yet again. "It calls to me. I will have it," Terran grimaced. At least it wasn't trying to fool him into thinking its voice was his own thoughts anymore. That concession had only taken, what, almost 1,000 years Earth time? He was grimly certain it was only because the malevolent entity had decided this open prodding was more effective. Terran felt oddly proud at the thought. He'd take any win he could get against this particular horror. At this moment, though, the Watcher wasn't his biggest problem. That honor belonged to the Telestry, the most bullheaded of the galaxy's human powers. "Lord Keeper, they're still on course for the Cassisia's crystal. Are you certain you want to keep pace with them? I'm getting..." Issachar had his face twisted into an expression Terran would normally have called unbecoming in an officer, and his oldest living friend, who was also Malak's captain, turned his head almost reflexively to see if someone was staring at him from behind. Terran sighed. "Yes, Issachar, I feel the Watcher. I know we must look to the safety of the sigil, but John and Rachel are in that crystal. Paul Cassisia loved them. He would never forgive me if I allowed the Telestry to harm them. Take heart. The Watcher cannot do anything to us unless we allow it to break us. Guard your thoughts." Issachar's face became an iron mask, and he nodded. "Of course, my lord." Terran could see the grim determination in his friend's expression, much as he tried to hide his emotions behind his Regalian stoicism. Issachar was a good man, the best he'd known since Paul Cassisia disappeared. Every trip into the abyss was a risk Terran couldn't afford. Even now, he knew the Watcher was pressing on the thoughts of every single member of his crew, trying to worm itself into their minds, tempting them to do something terrible, driving them insane. He had given orders that no crewman was to be alone with their minds under assault. With distant curiosity, Terran wondered if the Telestry crew even so much as felt the Watcher's gaze on the back of their necks, the way his own people did. He knew the Telestry was doing the Watcher's own work for it. Whatever meddling they planned to try on the crystal this time was beyond him. But if there was even a chance they might succeed, he had no choice but to follow them. "My lord, we've received a hail from the Telestry. It's the vessel Ocarist. It's Drake Loredan, my lord." Terran didn't allow his expression to change, but internally he cursed as the Watcher's gloating laugh boomed through the back of his mind. "Put him on, Issachar." "Here, my lord." Terran laughed mirthlessly. "If he's calling me in the abyss, he knows we're not speaking privately." In response, Drake Loredan's dark, brooding visage appeared on the screen, replacing the master plot. For a long moment, Loredan didn't speak, obviously studying Terran. Then Loredan's eyes narrowed. "What business have you here, Keeper of the Mysteries?" He was obviously putting on more of an act than he needed to, probably because Terran hadn't taken his calm privately. Terran had known Loredan for 400 Earth years, more than 150 years New Standard Time. Loredan was something of a showman, enough so that it was easy to forget how effective and operative he could be. He didn't bother with his act in front of Terran anymore, but with anyone else present, he couldn't seem to help himself. Terran frowned at Loredan. "The Kassizias are my charge, Telestic Loredan. I cannot allow harm to come to them." Loredan smiled almost convincingly, an affectation Terran knew had no purpose beyond provoking him. "Why, then, have you not freed them from their imprisonment?" On top of the irritation induced by the Watcher, the provocation worked. It was all Terran could do to keep his face smooth. "The time is coming, Loredan. I may not be able to free them, but Brightstar will. I am as nothing in his shadow." Loredan's sneer was somehow even worse than the smile had been. "Yes, your precious Brightstar. How long have you been waiting, Galton? 1,000 years? He laughed, though Terran could tell there was no real mirth in Loredan either. The Abyss was the furthest thing in the galaxy from a joke, and they both knew it, however much Loredan might play-act. After a moment, Loredan continued. "Don't worry, Keeper. When the Bright Star appears, the Telestry will do its part. You shall have your audience, even if we must stand to your defense. Malleus' wish will be fulfilled, if Bright Star ever comes." Loredan stopped, as if inviting him to speak. But Terran just stared grimly into the video pickup, waiting. Loredan liked to talk, and it was he who had initiated the call, after all. After another long pause, Loredan scowled. "If we should free the Kassizias, you will have your audience with them as well, even if the Bright Star is not present. Don't try my patience. This will be delicate." Terran ground his teeth. "You know the prophecies, Loredan. The Kassizias may not, must not be freed until the Bright Star comes." "Prophecies are chancy, Keeper. Our reading of the texts is somewhat different. We will reach the crystal within the day. Unless you wish to incur the wrath of the Telestry, stand clear. The ancient pact between us stands. You must not interfere." With that, Loredan cut the connection. As the seconds passed in the aftermath of Loredan's words, Issachar made no comment. The rest of the half-dozen or so bridge crew was too well disciplined to speak without leave. For his part, Terran was seething, but again he didn't show it. With the Watcher's relentless assault, his people were dealing with enough. His doubts must remain his own. And doubts he had. Even Loredan, with his centuries-long lifespan, was but a child compared to Terran. He had been waiting for the Bright Star for 1,000 years NST. That was 3,000 years Earth time, which was similar to that of Eteria, home of the Telestry. Most of the people of the Aurora Galaxy still aged at the same rate they always had, though some did live to be 40 standard years old now, 120 by Earth reckoning. He was the only one who remembered Earth anymore, and had been for a very long time. Terran was still in his prime, though he didn't know how that was possible. The older he got, the less he was certain of. Why did he age so slowly? What of Loredan, or the other Odds, as they were so quaintly called now? Time twisted all things. The ancient pact Loredan had spoken of had originally been nothing more than Paul Kassizia's annoyed admonition to the Telestri to mind what Terran told them and make sure to take the Bright Star to the Vale. Terran snorted in disgust. Paul's peevish instruction had gradually decayed in the Telestri's institutional memory, from a general command to obey, into no more than a grudging allowance that he got to have an audience once the Bright Star did finally show. His part in the ancient pact had never been specified, and he'd allowed the Telestri's fealty to Paul, to himself, and to the Tenets to decay too far. Not that their reverence of Paul had ever gone beyond lip service for more than a generation or two at a time. Malleus had been a breath of fresh air, but since Malleus it had decayed beyond even lip service. Terran knew he should have done something to bring them into line, but he didn't know what. The Telestri was completely unmanageable, and he was constantly occupied putting out some fire or other. As busy as he was dealing with the Ilvain, the Opterans, the Nocifer, or any of their other less organized minions, he always had some emergency to chase. He barely had time to think about the Dominion, the Telestri, or the other human polities. Whatever the cause, Terran had allowed the Telestri to become a problem, and short of invading Eteria, and taking command of the unruly Energemetris by force, he had little recourse but to play nice with what seemed to him troublesome children. He had seriously considered conquering them. Any of their energemetrists, or all at once, would be hard-pressed to overcome the power of the Sigil of Mysteries. But what was he going to do? Kill them all? Yes! Kill them all! The Watcher's invasion of his mind had never really gone away, and its taunt was a pointed reminder of where they were, and the cost of letting his thoughts run amok. Terran sighed and turned to Issachar. I will be in my quarters, old friend. Remember, Watcher protocols are in effect. Nobody goes anywhere alone. Double confirmation on every command decision. Issachar nodded at the order, redundant as it was. They all needed some redundancy in this place. Terran turned to leave, doing everything he could to prepare himself mentally for what he knew would be a long, difficult wait. 3 days later, Terran's tension had built so high that he was internally ready to exercise the conquest option on the little piece of the Telestri represented by Ocarist. He stared at the image of the Telestri vessel on Malak's viewscreen, the Kassizia's crystal in its primary cargo hold, with his jaw clamped shut so hard it ached. It had taken all the self-discipline he could muster to keep the Watcher at bay. First, as Malak shadowed Ocarist on its approach to the crystal with the Kassizia's entrapped in it. Then, while they attempted to do something, he still didn't know what, to the crystal itself. Malak's crew was showing the strain as well. Twice already, crew members had tried to harm themselves, and the Watcher's malevolent presence was still intensifying. Both times, the two-together rule had saved them. But it was only a matter of time before someone dove out an airlock, or worse, into one of the emitter coils. Issachar's determination also seemed only to have increased, and Terran was glad he wouldn't have to worry about his friend this time. The last time they had been in the abyss. His thoughts were interrupted by a loud exclamation from the technician at the sensor suite. But before Terran could speak, Issachar was already moving. What? What is it? The technician turned toward Issachar, his expression confused. I don't know, Captain. There's something off the port bow, I think. He shook his head as if bewildered. Well, what is it? Get it on the viewer. Issachar was nearly beside himself, and Terran could hardly blame him. Perhaps this was nothing, but at least it was a distraction from the constant creeping malevolence in their heads. Do you really think so? Gloating laughter echoed through his mind as Malak lurched horribly. The main view screen changed then to show a strange shape, only visible in the abyss's blackness because portions of it glowed slightly. Terran was already reaching for Energemetra 6, automatically using the Sigil of Mysteries around his neck as an amplifier. Terran had been using Energemetra 6 for literally thousands of years, though the colors in the room around him abruptly intensified, and he could clearly sense every object and every molecule if he chose. His focus was so practiced and automatic that he barely noticed. Terran's attention was already outside of Malak, using his Energemetra 6 sense to search for their foe. It wasn't quite like normal sight. Instead, he could sense the space and every molecule that occupied it. Not many out here. Whatever the enemy was, it had launched some kind of projectile at them, and Terran distantly sensed a giant crater on one side of his vessel. Subconsciously baring his teeth, Terran pushed his perception out into the void, looking for anything at all. Another incoming projectile streaked through his perception, and with Energemetra 6 boosted senses, it was like a tracer, pointing him straight at his target. Was that from some sort of railgun? It had moved blindingly fast. When projectiles were propelled up near the speed of light, as the one that had hit Malak was, even a tiny object the size of Terran's fist could tear through the entire vessel like a bullet through tissue paper. Malak had Energemetra 6 shields to protect it from such objects. But whatever the projectile was, it had exploded on impact. The energy released was so high that the weapons might as well have had nuclear warheads. Some of that was from the velocity, but it couldn't all have been so. Malak could only take so many hits like that one. Malak lurched around him again, but Terran barely noticed. He had found the enemy. Without stopping to properly look at the vessel before him, Terran lashed out. His Energemetra 6 specialization was Pyrrhic, but all that meant at his level of mastery was that he reached for it out of habit whenever there was no reason to do otherwise. The gout of pure plasmic energy that Terran released against his target was enough to consume 10 ships like Malak. His white-hot fury at being attacked on top of the pent-up frustration and tension that had inexorably grown as the Watcher tormented him and his crew combined into what he knew must be overkill. Nothing in this galaxy could stand up against the power he had just unleashed. It was cathartic. This unknown thing had hurt his ship and probably killed people aboard Malak he'd known since they were children. The eruption of power flowed around him and through the void, coalescing into a lance of fire, almost as large as Malak itself as it reached the enemy vessel to consume it. Or at least it should have. Instead, the blast wave of power flowed around the unknown enemy, rolling off as if magnetically repelled to streak into the void behind. Laughter boomed through Terran, almost breaking his hold on Energemetra 6, as his mind was frozen, brittle with shock. What had just happened was impossible. Everything in the universe was made from Energemetra 6. It was the power that underlay existence. How could this be?
"I will take the sigil from your corpse, from the wreckage of your precious Malak."
Real fear wormed into Terran's guts as the ship around him rocked yet again. Again he lashed out against the enemy, suppressed panic galvanizing him. Again his gout of power streamed away, blue white this time, only to wash over the other vessel without effect, while return fire rocked Malak. Alarms were sounding now, and Terran flailed with his power, trying over and over to land a blow while the enemy's attacks continued to roll in, and Terran felt despair gripping him. Grimly, he understood what would be required to defeat this foe. For reasons he could not understand, Energemetra 6 would not touch it. He needed physical projectiles, but this far out into the abyss, there wasn't so much as space dust for him to lay hold of. creating a physical object with Energemetra 6 that was large enough to damage that strange vessel was impossible. The entropic shock would kill him if he tried. Vaguely, as if from a world away, Terran heard Issachar saying something. Loredan. Terran struggled to focus enough to catch what his old friend was trying to tell him. The Kassizias. What? Terran blinked stupidly up at Issachar. Loredan is taking the Kassizias. They're free. Another blow, even more severe, slammed into Malak as Terran stared at Issachar in disbelief. That is impossible. They flinched as the Watcher's laughter boomed through both of them at the same time. Terran sagged in his seat as the blows abruptly stopped coming, and the Watcher's voice returned with even more force.
Too long you defied me. No more.
The gloating tone consumed Terran's world. Though his Energemetra 6 enhanced senses still spread like a net around Malak's ruptured hemorrhaging hole, Terran sensed the enemy turning. On the screen before them, the vessel pivoted, its angles somehow wrong, as if their geometry had come from a completely different place, where reality itself was alien. Then the enemy vessel released a projectile 4 times the size of anything that had so far battered his beleaguered ship. Even through Energemetra 6, he barely caught a glimpse of it as it streaked in to rip a hole completely through Malak, from one side to the other.
Die, Keeper!
Terran might as well have been dead even before the final projectiles ripped out of the enemy vessel. It was as if he could feel them coming, even before they launched, and nothing could stop it. But something did. An object barely bigger than a man appeared from the depths of the abyss, far beyond the enemy, moving even faster than the enemy's projectiles, which had been at close to the speed of light when they struck Malak. The object shone with Energemetra 6, so charged with power it would have blinded him if it actually emitted photons. To hold a charge like that, it must be some kind of crystal. It was much larger than the projectiles the enemy had shot at Malak, but compared to a space vessel, it was still impossibly small. How could it mount a drive capable of creating the Energemetra 6 distortion for superluminal travel? Nothing that small could possibly move so fast. The blows Malak had taken were terrible, but nothing Terran had ever heard of could propel a small object above the speed of light. That was why projectile weapons were so rare now. Whatever this was, it moved many times faster than it should have been able to. Terran's conception of reality took yet another blow as the object actually smashed into the enemy's vessel at an incalculable velocity. The impact energy was so immense that Terran had trouble understanding what he watched. It wasn't even an explosion at first. Instead, the enemy vessel simply vaporized where the crystal had passed through it, going from a physical state to an energy state, instantaneously. Then, well behind where the crystal had struck, the atomic energy it released consumed the rest of the vessel in a tremendous explosion. Out of the fireball, a man-sized object, now reduced to a speed barely 2 or 3 times that of light, streaked across Terran's perception, as if following Ocarus and the Kassizias. The screen in front of Terran was only just registering the enemy's destruction, as the little crystal disappeared out of Terran's perception once more. The Watcher's howl of inarticulate rage was awful, but the pressure it had been holding against Terran's mind suddenly, finally slackened, as its champion was destroyed. Issachar grunted. Took you long enough. Terran simply stared at him, his mind reeling. Then understanding bloomed fully within him, and he laughed, true mirth and joy rolling freely out of him for the first time he could remember. Terran clapped Issachar on the shoulder. That was not me. In fact, he grinned, that was the bright star. Follow that crystal.
And that is Keeper of the Mysteries. Yeah. Prequel to the Bright Star story? Or 5 minutes before?
yeah, something like that. It just leads into it. It's like an extra prologue for people who are interested in Bright Star. If that story interests you, go take a look. Bright Star is available wherever you'd buy books now, and particularly at e6universe.com. Or please, please take a look at the Kickstarter. We do need people to pledge to that. We're getting close to the point where it actually would end if it's not fully funded. So make sure by the end of the month, if you have a chance, pledge to the Kickstarter. What's up?
I asked for the close date, end of the month.
It is the end of April.
Okay.
Wonderful. Thanks for being here, everybody. Unless you got anything further, Greg, let's call it for the week.
Yep. Thanks so much, guys. We'll see you next time.
Sounds good.